This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها منه ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our top stories this hour. Two more Palestinians are killed at the hands of Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Iran's foreign minister says it is possible to achieve an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal if the American side acts realistically. And a Twitter whistleblower says the firm is a decade behind security standards and its cybersecurity failures cause real harm to real people. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour. Hours ago, Israeli forces killed two Palestinian men in the West Bank city of Jenin amid escalating tensions in the occupied territories. According to Israeli media reports, the two men lost their lives during an alleged firefight at the Jalma checkpoint north of Jenin. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in the city's refugee camp. Tensions remain high across the West Bank as the Israeli military has stepped up its daily raids. According to Palestinian sources, regime forces have killed some 120 people in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip since the beginning of this year. Earlier, we asked our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to tell us more about the latest deadly confrontation in Jenin. Here is her account.
Israeli military declared that the Israeli soldiers had killed two Palestinians and took their bodies. Later, Israeli media revealed that an Israeli force raided the village of Kfar Dan in Jenin and they interrogated family members of two Palestinians, a 23-year-old Ahmed Abed and a 22-year-old Hani Subhi Abed. It seems that the two, they are cousins, and they ordered family members to go and to check the bodies of those two. You have mentioned the Israeli military continues a widespread operation, mainly in Jenin, and also they use excessive force and they use their guns in order to shoot and kill Palestinians. So it's the Israeli military story, but at the end of the day, what the Israeli soldiers are doing is an attempt to prevent Palestinians to be engaged in any form of resistance against the Israeli forces.
A senior delegation of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas that's been visiting Moscow for several days continues to discuss matters of mutual concern with senior Russian officials. In their latest meetings, Hamas representatives have held talks with the chairman of the Russian State Duma Committee on International Affairs and the chair of the Russian Federation Council Committee on Foreign Affairs. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is leading the delegation that includes members of the Political Bureau. The Palestinian side has stressed the need for maintaining a strategic relationship with Russia during this visit, which it says is being conducted at Moscow's request. The two sides have also discussed the current situation of Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as the Israeli violations. Tensions have recently escalated between Russia and Israel over the regime's support for Ukraine, as well as its repeated attacks on Syria. Iran's foreign minister says it is possible to achieve a final agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal if the American side acts realistically. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with his Nigerian counterpart, Jeffrey Onyema. Iran's top diplomat reaffirmed Tehran's commitment to continue negotiations with the other parties to the deal known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdullahian said Tehran is determined to achieve a strong and durable agreement. He expressed hope the UN nuclear agency IAEA fulfills its technical duties free from politics. Iran had said earlier that IAEA's chief claim of a gap in the agency's knowledge about the Iranian nuclear program lacked legal basis. Tehran says it would fulfill its JCPOA commitments only if the deal is restored, sanctions are removed, and other parties return to their obligations under the deal. A startling revelation by Israel's spy agency. The Mossad chief says the agency will continue to act against Iran with or without the revival of the 2015 deal. If the past is anything to go by, these include things like the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists or damaging the country's nuclear facilities. Even though Israel has never admitted to these terrorist acts, it once again shows how desperate it is to prevent Iran and others from the success of sanction relief talks.
When it comes to Iran, Israel has never refrained from relaying its sentiment, especially when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. It has always maintained that Iran is after weaponizing its nuclear program, and it has gone out of its way to provide the IAEA and the US with fabricated evidence to prove its false claim. But Israel may have stepped too far in its latest claim against Iran and the JCPOA sanctions removal talks. The head of Israel's spy agency Mossad said the revival of a nuclear deal with world powers will not give Iran immunity from Israeli operations. This is a fully loaded statement, which if taken a look at closely, actually proves that Israel has executed destructive and lethal acts against Iran, including sabotaging its nuclear program, destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, to name a few. David Bernier, in his first speech since becoming Mossad's chief, has said, "We won't take part in this charade. Even if a deal is signed, it will not provide immunity from Mossad operations." Even though Israel has never admitted to acting against Iran, this can be interpreted that the opposite is true. Iran's response to these statements were to the point. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said, "We do not expect a terrorist regime anything other than terrorist actions." Some Israeli acts of terrorism against Iran include the assassination of four nuclear scientists and damaging Iran's nuclear facility in Karaj. Now, the question is, will the international community react to this, or will it wait until Israel commits another act of violence or terrorism against Iran?
Israel is a rogue nation. It is a terrorist nation. It will not adhere to international law. It will not respect international law. The fact that it has been working against Iran, assassinating scientists and other means against Iran, just indicates that it is a rogue nation, that if the JCPOA should be resurrected, Israel will not respect Iran's borders as it has not in the past. We have to remember that Israel has been has violated international law repeatedly, not only in Palestine, Iran, but Syria and Lebanon. Israel has no regard for international law, has no regard for human rights. So these statements by the Mossad chief are just consistent with Israel's criminal activities.
The former head of security at Twitter, Peter Zatko, has testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on the social media platform's major data security flaws. We discussed the matter earlier in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, for the former head of security at Twitter has testified before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee on the social media platform's major data security flaws.
What I discovered when I joined Twitter was that this enormously influential company was over a decade behind industry security standards. The company's cybersecurity failures make it vulnerable to exploitation, causing real harm to real people. And when an influential media platform can be compromised by teenagers, thieves, and spies, and the company repeatedly creates security problems on their own, this is a big deal for all of us. When I brought concrete evidence of these fundamental problems to the executive team and repeatedly sounded the alarm of the real risks associated with them, and these were problems brought to me by the engineers and employees of the company themselves, the executive team chose instead to mislead its board, shareholders, lawmakers, and the public instead of addressing them.
This committee will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
Mayor Zlatko told the lawmakers that half of the company's leadership is, quote, misleading the public. He said its staff are mainly engineers with access to users' personal information. He also said that he was worried that, quote, rogue employees could have access to information without leaving a trace. The former Twitter official said the company, quote, can be compromised by teenagers, thieves, and spies. For years, various whistleblowers have claimed Twitter is utilizing user data to accumulate revenue. For more on that, we are joined by Eric Wahlberg, Canadian author and journalist from Toronto. Also, Daniel Lazar, journalist and author from New York. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Wahlberg. Mr. Wahlberg, are you surprised to hear this kind of testimony where they say even teenagers, Twitter can be compromised by teenagers, now let alone thieves and spies who are actually looking for ways to accumulate data, but the fact that this could be open to someone under 20 would actually be shocking, wouldn't it?
Yes, we don't have a way of dealing sensibly with the internet. It has become the world communication. Facebook, especially, and Twitter are the really our social lives online. And they're controlled by who? Zuckerberg, a computer geek that kind of put something together, and now he's controlling our minds, basically. And the same with Twitter. That really, there has to be some way of dealing with this with national governments. And the EU is trying, but North America, we're both behind on trying to. And it's very difficult. You really have to work together. Governments have, this is what the United Nations should be for, is to provide this kind of platform for nations to have. There should be a security, a UN agency of social media, something like that.
So, Mr. Lazar, in your opinion, this kind of testimony, can it lead to something good? Can we expect Twitter to up its security?
Well, and bear in mind, this man was testifying before a Senate committee, and there is no more corrupt body on earth than the U.S. Senate. So we've got to take this all with a grain of salt. I mean, Twitter is the subject of a takeover battle. It has enemies all around. Last year, it was a Twitter employee named Francis Hogan testified that Twitter was making people crazy, driving them insane, inducing all kinds of psychotic reactions that made no sense whatsoever. And so no one knows what's going on behind the scenes, whether this is somehow stems from the takeover battle, whether others are trying to use this testimony to take down Twitter, or whether the senators themselves are engaged in an elaborate shakedown scheme in order to wring campaign contributions out of Twitter. I mean, it's a very corrupt scene in Washington, and really we can really assume the worst. We can assume that there are all kinds of dangerous cross currents going on behind the scenes.
So back to you, Mr. Wahlberg. I assume that some kind of testimony like this, and of course, Mr. Lazar did mention that we can't hope anything to come out from the Senate, but do you think that this will probably raise public awareness and people will be more vigilant in using Twitter and other social media platforms?
I beg to differ with Daniel. I have a little bit more optimism that these corrupt senators, well, it's still a political process, and it's really got to be dealt with through the government at some point. So whether it goes to Congress or there'll be enough outcry at this point. But there has to be a call for some real control, and that's so difficult. So maybe it's not going to happen. But I mean, there's BBC or CBC, which could be dismantled if the Conservatives get in Canada. But that kind of regulatory board, there should be something that, and maybe this will finally push the nations to really do something. Well, it's happening. Russia, China, Iran. You have your own way of organizing social media, and that's what has to happen. I think that it's the monopoly. It's basically Facebook, Twitter. They're a world monopoly, and they're all powerful. So it really goes down to a national level to somehow deal with that. And I don't know, maybe the EU, but it's so torn. And well, now the politics has gone crazy. I don't think that anything out of Europe with this war going on. So.
Thank you very much, Mr. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author from New York, and Mr. Eric Wahlberg, Canadian author and journalist from Toronto. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review, and thanks to all of you viewers for following.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou
roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Arbaeen lessons and messages. Last century, only a few ulama or religious scholars would march on foot towards Karbala to visit the Master of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, on the 40th day of his martyrdom, known as Arbaeen. Therefore, no one would think to see millions of followers of Imam Hussein who flocked to Iraq for pilgrimage for the Prophet's dear grandson, Imam Hussein, who sacrificed his life to save mankind from ignorance and going astray. For the past several years, over 30 million people from across Iraq and all over the Islamic world let the magnet of Hussein attract their hearts, so that from several weeks before Arbaeen, Iraq, especially the route between Najaf and Karbala, becomes the scene of the greatest ever crowd of human beings throughout history. According to the Iraqi government statistics, in 2015, more than 27 million pilgrims had participated in the Arbaeen March, and over 17,500 stands, called Mukeb in Arabic, were set up by the Iraqi people for rendering every kind of service to the pilgrims. The services provided to the pilgrims included three-time meals and resting places. According to an official figure, over 700 million meals had been distributed among pilgrims in the Arbaeen March before the coronavirus pandemic. let the enemies boycott the unmatched and unprecedented splendor of Arba'in and the purity of love of tens of millions of people who flock to Karbala to show that Imam Hussein is the Lord of their hearts. Let the hired media and journalists affiliated and paid by the United States and the Israeli regime kill their conscience and shut their eyes to the greatest human ocean in history, which is getting greater and greater every year, without any propaganda or publicity. This is really astounding. Over 50 million people were killed in the two world wars. Thousands of people have been killed in different wars and conflicts during history, but no trace of them has remained. What is the mystery of Imam Hussein and his 72 companions, which keeps ruling the hearts, shining with an ever-increasing glory, transcending history and geography? This is why the tyrants of history have always tried to erase the memory of Hussein and his unique movement by every means. The Abbasid tyrant, Mutawakkil, even destroyed the grave of Imam Hussein through harrowing it and submerging the area to annihilate any trace of Hussein. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, clarified the goal of his movement when he said, "O God, you know that what we have done has not been a rivalry for power or reaching the worldly gain. But my goal is to return the signs of your religion to their place and reform your land so that the oppressed among your servants get security and the obligations, traditions, and orders of your religion are performed." The Arba'in March has been called the Journey of Love and Faith, the love of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, and faith in their thought and practice. The followers of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, get prepared for Arba'in several days and weeks before they set off on the journey. Naturally, this multitude of people in a few routes may create problems, but pilgrims endure all problems with patience and self-sacrifice. Brotherhood and affection helps them tolerate the hardships. They try to follow Imam Hussein when he told his son, "My son, be steadfast on truth, even if it may be bitter." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Friendship of a faithful with another faithful is among the biggest branches of faith. And whoever loves for God's sake and hates for God's sake and spends our God's sake and spares for God's sake will be considered among the select." The travelers of the Arba'in March have been selected to introduce freedom, humanity and affection to the world. The Iraqi people provide services to the pilgrims wholeheartedly at every mokeb without any expectations. They have learnt from their imam, where Hussein says, "Anyone who serves his brother in faith for God's satisfaction, God will give him in return and will remove the calamities of the world more than his service. And whoever removes the grief of a faithful, God will remove his griefs in the world and the hereafter. And whoever does a good deed, God will do him good, and God likes the doers of good deeds." The banner of Imam Hussein's uprising was hoisted for truth and justice. Pilgrims on the day of Arba'in greet Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, who was martyred to defend the religion of all prophets, namely pure monotheism. The pilgrims of Arba'in make a covenant to follow Hussein's path in defense of the oppressed and fighting the oppressor. Since this cause is beyond religion and thought, the Arba'een March has become an international event in which many non-Muslims from Asia, Africa, Europe and the Americas take part. Muslims from countries like Syria, Yemen and Afghanistan converge in this huge human ocean to recount the crimes of the Western regimes. The Saudi regime, which pays terrorist outfits to assassinate thousands of innocent people in the name of Islam.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On September 8, 2022, Queen Elizabeth II died at the age of 96. As her death prompted an outpouring of grief from her admirers, it also revived criticism of her legacy, bringing into relief the complex feelings of those who consider her as a symbol of the British colonial empire, an institution that enshrined itself through violence, theft, and oppression. Thank you. Elizabeth II died less than a year after Barbados removed her as its head of state and became a republic, a move that partly stemmed from growing criticism of the British monarchy among Caribbean countries.
Presiding within the under English colonial rule, it becomes the laboratory for plantation societies in the Caribbean. It is in Barbados that English law, for the first time, knows a distinction in the racial status of subjects of the crown, in the sense that laws are passed which say essentially that people who are Negroes, and that word is borrowed from the Spanish, are fit for particular kinds of punitionary laws, as the text runs. So it is Barbados thus becomes the laboratory for a slave society, which is then exported to Jamaica in the 1650s and 60s, and to the Carolinas and then Georgia after that.
Others, including Jamaica, have hinted at declaring their independence too.
60 years of independence. We have not forgotten, and we demand an apology and reparation.
Our goal is to loosen and remove the hands, the gloved hands of the Queen from around our necks so that we can breathe.
Earlier in August, Senator Lydia Thorpe of Australia called Queen Elizabeth a colonizer during her swearing-in ceremony.
To the colonizing Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
Senator Thorpe.
The start of Queen Elizabeth's reign in 1952 coincided with her government ordering the suppression of the Mau Mau independence uprising in Kenya.
We made a point repeatedly that it looked extremely immoral for Her Majesty's government, which is not contesting and has in fact admitted that atrocities were committed, torture was committed, that they have admitted. Now for them to continue relying on technicalities, being well aware that the majority of these victims are in the 80s, late 80s, that many of them live in squalid poverty, that many of them are not even able to afford health care in their old age. What could be more despicable? What could be more immoral than Her Majesty's government to continue as it were, to buy time, simply to wait for all these veterans to die one by one before tasting justice?
Much of the protesters were put in concentration camps and used as slave labor if they weren't murdered by British soldiers. Almost 1 year after the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II, she oversaw one of the nastiest coup d'etats in modern history. Planned by Britain's MI6 and then executed by America's CIA, the coup overthrew Iran's democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, paving the way for the tyrannical regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that lasted for almost three decades and sowing distrust of the British among the Iranian nation. Elizabeth's reign was marked by rocky periods of irregular violence abroad, including Britain's ill-fated attempt to gain control of the Suez Canal in 1956 and the Falklands War, a 10-week-long battle with Argentina in 1982, in which the British responded to Buenos Aires' reclamation of territory with flames of war. Closer to home, the British Army waged its longest military campaign to date, Operation Banner, an effort to establish order during the Troubles, a bloody sectarian conflict that engulfed much of Northern Ireland between 1968 and 1998. British troops were given a green light to massacre 14 civilians in Northern Ireland on a protest march against Britain's policy of jailing Catholics without trial. the British establishment oversaw cover-up inquiries into what became known as Bloody Sunday. In the twilight years of the Queen's rule, her government invaded Iraq on the pretext of destroying non-existent weapons of mass destruction. During the long years of a joint British and U.S. occupation, it is likely that more than 1 million Iraqis died, and millions more were driven from their homes. Over centuries, the UK has funneled trillions of dollars from its colonies to enrich itself. The monarchy was built on slavery, establishing a slave trade that saw the transport of millions of Africans and South and North Americans to other countries. The slave trade was so vast, in fact, that it wasn't until 2015 that the country fully paid off its debts to slave owners from freeing slaves in the 19th century. Although Queen Elizabeth II did not herself enact these policies, her reign was a continuation of the earlier ones. Some historians believe she bears responsibility for all these atrocities. In the words of Harvard University history professor Maya Jasanoff, by design as much as by the accident of her long age, her presence as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, an association of Britain and its former colonies, put a stolid traditionalist front over decades of violent upheaval. As such, the Queen helped obscure a bloody history of decolonization whose proportions and legacies have yet to be adequately acknowledged. All in all, as Commander-in-Chief of the British Armed Forces, Queen Elizabeth oversaw a great number of wars and conflicts, including the Mau Mau Uprising in Kenya, the Jebel Akhdar War in Oman, the Cyprus Emergency, the Suez Crisis in Egypt, the Border Campaign in Ireland, the First Cod War in Iceland, the Upper Jaffa Disturbance in Yemen, the Dhofar Rebellion in Oman, the Indonesia-Malaysia confrontation in Borneo, the Aden Emergency in Yemen, the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the Second Cod War in Iceland, the Third Cod War in Iceland, the Falklands War in Argentina, the multinational force in Lebanon, the Persian Gulf War in Iraq, the Bosnian War, Operation Desert Fox in Iraq, the Kosovo War, the Sierra Leone Civil War, the War in Afghanistan, the Iraq War, the First Libyan Civil War, Operation Shader in Iraq and Syria. Taraka Love, senior newsletter writer for New York Magazine, wrote, "For 96 years, that colonizer has been sucking up the Earth's resources. You can't be a literal oppressor and not expect the people you have oppressed not to rejoice on news of your death." Last but not least, the royal family's deep-seated racism appeared to persist even to the last days of the Queen. In 2020, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, left the royal family over racism within the family. Like all monarchs, Elizabeth was both an individual and an institution. As for her individual life, there is little information beyond her love of horses and dogs or a dysfunctional family. As an institution, not much to take pride in. A disappeared empire and a list of wars that claimed many innocent lives.
in the limelight.
The number of supporters of the Republican system in England has now reached the highest level since 1993, and less than 57% of people want the survival of the monarchy. The death of Queen Elizabeth II, while reminding the controversial events during her life and the scandals of the royal family, has strengthened the position of independence seekers and Republicans, and also weakened the position of supporters of the monarchy in the United Kingdom. The monarchy system in England is hereditary, and the people, even their representatives, have no role in determining the successor of the Queen or the King, who is the highest authority in the country. Now, with the death of the 96-year-old Queen Elizabeth II of England, her eldest son, Charles III, is in charge of the institution of the monarchy, and his son, William, will become the new Crown Prince of England. We take a look at some of the world press and news agencies who have covered this story. Please stay with us. Fast Company, an American magazine, writes, calls for an end to the British monarchy are gaining momentum following the death of Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's longest reigning monarch. The flag bearer for the movement to abolish the monarchy is the Republic Campaign, which is the largest lobbying group for British Republicans who seek to overturn the government into a republic with an elected head of state. The platform, which argues that the thousand-year-old monarchy has no place in modern society and that its wealth costs taxpayers millions of pounds per year, has in the past seen upticks in support as assorted scandals have tarnished the royal family's public image. Meanwhile, other critics argue that the majestic facade of Buckingham Palace hides an ugly legacy of ruthless imperialism and colonialism. Graham Smith, spokesperson for Republic, said, "People still have every right to say whatever they think. They shouldn't feel cowed. But there is a lot of concern, particularly on social media, about being censored or saying the wrong thing. As a public office, they claim that they have the right to speak up against the monarchy." Graham Smith explained, "Obviously, people will be careful not to cause offence, but this is also a public office that needs to be debated." The group say that they saw a rise in the support to their cause immediately after the announcement of the Queen's death. Beyond Britain, people in countries under the Commonwealth rule, which spans Canada to Jamaica to New Zealand, have also begun to call for an end to royal authority. The English monarchy has been criticised throughout history for its long-reigning atrocities and unimaginable tyranny over other nations and towards indigenous peoples. Forbes, an American business magazine, explains more about the story. A day after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, Britain's longest reigning monarch, there have been vocal calls across social media to abolish the monarchy. The hashtags #AbolishTheMonarchy and #NotMyKing have been trending, while a variety of images and memes have been shared to make the point. The question can be asked whether this is the appropriate time to have the discussion, and if not, then when is the right time? Dr. Dane Kennedy, Elmer Lewis Kaiser, Professor Emeritus of History and International Affairs at George Washington University, said, "You get the same kind of response that now isn't the time to have a discussion about gun control following a mass shooting incident." Dr. Dane Kennedy continued, "My response is that it is a perfectly legitimate time to question the future of the monarchy. Republican, anti-royalist sentiments have existed for a very long time, but they wax and wane. Now they are simply waxing a bit more. One reason is that Charles III is not the right person to sit on the throne instead of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. There's also been much of the mockery on social media directed at the new monarch, King Charles III. A meme made the rounds pointing out that he has spent much of his life basically unemployed. The succession of Charles has prompted strong reactions from politicians and activists in former British colonies in the Caribbean, who have called for the abolition of the British monarchy. In March of this year, a group of 100 Jamaican political activists published an open letter to Prince William, the new monarch's eldest son, demanding reparations. The Guardian newspaper sheds more light on the story, saying, "Civil liberties campaigners and others have expressed alarm about the response of police to anti-monarchy protesters amid a number of incidents, the latest of which included the arrest of a man in Edinburgh for apparently heckling Prince Andrew." The advocacy group Liberty said that new powers recently given to the police to curtail protests and how they were being enforced by police officers were a cause for deep concern. The Labour MP, Zara Sultana, said in response to incidents in Edinburgh, London and Oxford, "No one should be arrested for just expressing Republican views. Extraordinary and shocking that this needs saying." Police in Scotland said a 22-year-old man and a 52-year-old man had been arrested in connection with a breach of the peace on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh shortly before 3 p.m. local time on Monday, 12th of September. Earlier, a woman was charged after being arrested by police in Edinburgh on Sunday, 11th of September, as she staged a protest during the accession proclamation by the King. Police said the woman, a 22-year-old, had been arrested on Sunday outside St. Giles' Cathedral in connection with a breach of the peace and would appear at Edinburgh Sheriff Court at a later date. The woman was seen holding a sign that said, "Abolish the monarchy." When she was arrested moments before the reading of the proclamation, the incident took place outside the cathedral where the Queen's coffin lay on Monday. In London, a barrister and a climate activist who had held up a blank piece of paper in Parliament Square said he had been threatened with arrest by a police officer under the Public Order Act. In November of 2021, ahead of the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, an Ipsos poll found that only 60% of the British public favoured the country remaining a monarchy, down from 76% 5 years ago. The Platinum Jubilee celebrations were countered by an international anti-monarchy conference which raised the slogan, "Make Elizabeth the Last."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of jurisprudence in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. So here we are to discuss another issue, that's abortion. All right, Siddiqa, in our previous sessions, we are talking about abortion, different forms. Now, I want to ask you, there's something called as honor killing in the Asian countries, especially, wherein you see a female, she was involved in a relationship, or she was raped, or which the family was not liking, or they were not... They actually didn't want their dignity to go down and all, especially the rape cases. So when this female is pregnant with a child, they try to abort the child and name it as honor killing. What does Islam say on that?
So basically, in some countries, like you rightly mentioned, a woman is given very few rights in herself. And if, for example... For God forbid, a rape were to occur, she would be killed as part of an honor killing program to save the honor of the family, while the man is let go without much consequences. Now, if the woman in such a case were to become pregnant, if anyone finds out, then there's a possibility of her being killed for a crime she did not commit. Now, some scholars, and I stress on the term some over here.
Okay.
Some scholars would say because her own life is in danger and bringing this child into this world would bring exceedingly difficult circumstances and would be very harmful to her. Therefore, before ensoulment, they could be...
Allowed to go for abortion.
They could be allowed to go for abortion. Or here, again, I stress the term some. Because some would... Say, if there are other ways, such as giving the child up for adoption or going through other agencies.
Other alternatives. Okay.
Then it wouldn't be permissible, sorry. So yes, and some scholars would say in these cases where it would bring exceedingly difficult circumstances for the woman herself for a crime she did not commit and was forced into it.
She can go for abortion, but before ensoulment.
Before ensoulment. Okay. Which today's world, it's quite easy to recognize that a woman is pregnant. I think within 6 weeks, within 5 weeks, she can easily find out that she's pregnant.
And sometimes even before that.
Sometimes even before that, correct. So today we have a lot of technology at hand to be able to come to a conclusion of what exactly is happening.
Yeah.
And so that the right choices can be made before it gets too late.
Oh, well, let me ask you again. So what is the actual time in Islam when the soul enters a body?
Generally, they keep it at around 20 weeks.
Okay.
Which is just around 5 months.
So you're trying to say if women goes for abortion before these 20 weeks, some scholars say it's okay, she can.
In extraordinary circumstances where her life or the life of the child would be in danger.
Not like always.
It's not an absolute rule that a woman is allowed to go for abortion, absolute rule. It's not an absolute rule at all.
Even if it's before 20 weeks.
Yes, even if it's before 20 weeks, if it's a viable, safe, healthy pregnancy with no harm to the mother and it's just unwanted, therefore it doesn't, because just want does not define the laws. Islam does not look at what I want or what you want.
Okay.
There is a set of rights and a set of rules we need to abide by. Because if there were no rules and rights that we were allowed to abide by, we would each be transgressing the other person's rights.
Exactly, like because you're looking at your own rights, you're not looking at the right to life that this fetus has. Yeah.
Yes, and Islam does not take that.
And see how this is the beauty of Islam. A fetus that is not even 20 weeks old. Islam gives it a right to life.
Islam gives it its own right, not only even the right to life, they even have the right to inheritance.
Wow.
When I was looking through the rights of inheritance as part of my course, it's very extensive as to how Islam would even take into account if they were in those days when obviously the right now it's just been maybe 10, 20, 30 odds that we have sonographs in place where we can see